أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والسيد المرسلين والشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأصل والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم للآن إلى قيام يوم الدين أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي For the hastening of the advent of our 12th Imam, Imam Al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad and the family of Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. As we mark the shahada, the martyrdom anniversary of our fifth Imam, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, alayhi salatu wassalam, tonight, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I want to first off take this opportunity to offer our condolences to the Imam of our time, Imam Al-Hujjah, and to all of us on this sad occasion. And we ask Allah to accept this act of worship from us tonight and to allow us to make the ziyarat of our fifth Imam in this world. And we also ask Allah to give us the shafaat, the intercession of the fifth Imam on the Day of Judgment. For the hastening of the advent of our 12th Imam, who will return to avenge the blood of all of the Imams who was killed before him, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Before I go into the theme for tonight, I just want to make a bit of a note about some of the ahkam. You know, every night, as you know, we have Jamaat prayers daily, Dhuhrain and Maghribain. And so when we get together for the prayers, sometimes after the prayers, brothers come to me and they ask for some clarification on some of the ahkam, some of the rulings of the Salat. And as you also recall that many times before the majlis begins, I've been going over daily ahkam. We've already covered the Salatul Jamaat rules. We began to discuss the rules of eating and drinking within a Western society. But one of the things which has come up many times, and I was asked by one of the brothers to just remind ourselves about it, because obviously it's always good to remind ourselves, because we tend to forget things and, you know, neglect some obligations we have, is about the actions and the prayers. Two rules I want to mention. One of them is that in every action of the prayer, not so much the dhikr and what we say, but more so the actions that we perform, we should never be going before the imam of the jamaat. So meaning before the imam goes into ruku, nobody in the congregation should already be in the state of ruku. Either at the same time as the imam, we should go into ruku, or slightly thereafter. And we've seen instances where people are going into ruku before the imam goes into ruku, that's a problem. And also there are times when people go so late into ruku that they almost miss the ruku. That's also a problem. Whether it be the ruku, the sajda, any of the actions in the prayers, these need to be done. Not good, not that it's better, but they have to be done at the same time or after the imam. And failing to do so actually means that your jamaat prayers can be nullified. Now, that means not only a reduction in the thawab, but that can actually mean your prayers, your namaz itself could be null and void. Because if your jamaat is null, you need to switch your niyat to a farada prayer, and you have to perform those actions on your own that you would normally do behind the imam of the jamaat. So if you're, you know, not doing that, then your jamaat is gone and your actual prayers itself are null and void. So something to keep in mind, that you have to do the actions slightly after or at the same time as the imam of the jamaat. The second point which was brought to my attention that I wanted to remind ourselves about is an obligation in the salat, which is the covering of the body. Now we know for our ladies, they have a special hijab that they have to wear. For the women, as they know, but I'll remind ourselves for it, is the entire body, head to toe, has to be covered. The face can remain open, the hands from the wrist to the fingers can remain open, and the feet from the ankles below can remain open. That's not a problem for women. Other than that, the entire body has to be covered. And it has to be covered in such a way that, for example, the chador or whatever they're wearing is not see-through, that it would show, for example, the actual skin of the body. And as the scholars mention, to ensure that they have covered the wajibat, it is required to cover a bit more. So the face can remain open, but you should cover a bit more. Up to the wrist is okay, but you should cover a bit more. Up to the ankle is okay, but you should cover a bit more. Because when you go to ruku, you go into sajda, inevitably the clothing will lift a bit. And the same goes for the men. Men have it a bit easier. As we know, all we have to cover are the private parts, the front and the back. And that has to be covered. Sometimes you might be wearing tight jeans or tight pants and a short shirt. And you're standing in qiyam and no problem. But guess what? When you go into ruku or sajda, those who are behind you can see things of your body that they shouldn't be seeing from behind. And if it's done unintentionally, that's okay. But if you know that when you go to ruku or sajda, your shirt will lift up a bit, or your pants aren't proper, and you pray in that way, and you don't bother to learn the rule, guess what? Ayatollah Sistani and many other marajah say, your namaz is null and void. It has to be repeated again. So for the men, it's imperative to ensure that our pants are not so tight or short, and our shirt is not so tight or short that our backside shows when we go into ruku or sajda. This will invalidate the prayers, and it will mean that you need to repeat all of those again. If it meant 10 years of prayers you did in that form, then guess what? Those have to be done again, because that is a requirement to cover the private parts during salat. Even if nobody's in the room with you, it's just you alone praying. As men, we know it is mustahab. It's wajib to cover minimal the private parts. Mustahab is from the belly button to the knees. So young men, for example, if they're playing sports, yes, they can wear shorts when they're praying, but it's better to cover up to the knees, and it's better to obviously cover the entire body, even for the men. Obviously not like the women with their hair and the head covered, but it is still a recommendation for men to also go to that next level to cover a bit more of the body. And again, and let me just end with this, that realize when we're praying, who we're talking to, we're talking to Allah. Sure, He knows what we look like when we don't have our clothes on, but as a form of respect, we don't stand in front of Allah in disrespectful clothing. You know, when I go for a job interview, I brush my hair, I brush my teeth, I comb my hair, I put my best suit on, my tie, I'm looking like I want the job. So if I'm going in front of the best of managers, the best of creators, the only creator, it stands to reason I should look a bit respectable in front of Allah. And if that means that I have 2 minutes to change my clothes, then that's what we should do to ensure that we are fulfilling our obligation. May Allah help all of us in following our obligations and following the ahkam, so that we can ensure that our actions, especially our salat, are accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Tonight, as I mentioned, we've gathered together to mark the martyrdom anniversary of our fifth Imam, Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam. And obviously, I don't want to go too much over time. I know that we all have school and work tomorrow, so I'm going to cut my presentation tonight very brief. I still want to try to focus on one hadith from the Imam on a way to mold our lives and to look at some other aspects of our lives in the words of the fifth Imam, but just some facts and figures about our Imam. We know that the fifth Imam was born in the month of Rajab according to the most acceptable of narrations, although there are differences of opinion on months and dates, but I don't want to get into that. But he was born in the year 57 after the Hijrah. And so, you know, because we relate a lot of our things in our history to Karbala, that means he was about 4 or 5 years old when Karbala transpired. And yes, he was there in Karbala, young boy of only 4 or 5 years old, but nonetheless, we see that he was present. He was one of the three who would obviously be imams who witnessed the tragedy of his family members and the friends of his family in Karbala. And he died in the year 114, so it's easy to remember it. You take his birth year 57, you double it, you get his death date, and you subtract 114 from 57, you get his age, 57 years old. It's interesting when you look at his history, that he lived during the time of 10 different Bani Umayyah caliphs. 10 of the khulafa of Bani Umayyah is the time period of the fifth Imam. Obviously, the very first would have been the cursed Muawiyah, and obviously his son Yazid, and that entire chain. So he lived during the time of 10 Khulafa, and his imamat was during the period of five of the Bani Umayyah caliphs. And this is interesting. Obviously, I don't have time to go into the history tonight. But when you think about that, that in 10-year, in that 57-year period, rather, the government changes hands 10 times. And in fact, if you look at post-Karbala, you'll see that the Khulafa only ruled for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. You know, I mean, Yazid, la'natullah alayh, a prime example, 2 years after Karbala, he loses his life. And after him, every time a caliph would come, he would rule for a short period, he would be killed, or something would happen to him. So this was a very tumultuous time. It was a very difficult time for the Ahlul Bayt, alayhum as-salam, for the Muslim community on a whole, and for really all of those people within the Muslim lands. Because when you have government changing hands so frequently, you realize that, you know, people are going to do anything that they can to stay in power, to stay in authority. And ultimately, this is how we see that the fifth imam is shaheed, is martyred, is because of this constant power struggle amongst the Bani Umayyah, that they wanted to retain authority, whether it meant killing their own brother, killing their father, killing their children. For many of these so-called rulers of the community, it didn't matter what they did to attain and retain their power. And so when you look at, and I just mentioned this very briefly, when you look at the life of the fifth imam, and especially you look at the corpus of hadith, the sayings of the imam that we have, it's no wonder that he was speaking about many of the issues that were pertinent to society at that time. In fact, when you look at the hadith, and we refer to him as al-Baqir, because al-Baqir means one who splits open something. And so when we call him Baqir al-Ulum, he literally split open knowledge. Knowledge up until that time, in the time of Bani Umayyah, no, even before that, from the time of the death of Rasulullah up until the time of, we could say, the fifth imam, knowledge of Islam had been kept hidden. It had been kept under wraps to such an extent, and I'm sure we've heard this before, that during the time of the first three khulafa, it was forbidden. It was haram to write hadith. You weren't allowed to write hadith. In fact, there are books where sayings are quoted from the second caliph, where he would ask people, if you've written anything of Rasulullah, bring me that writing. And they would bring him the books of hadith, and rather than respect them as how Rasulullah lived, he would burn the hadith. And this continued for over 60 to 70 years, the prohibition of writing hadith, of learning about religion, of keeping religion relegated to maybe the Quran, and even that at a very superficial level. And so when the fifth imam comes on the scene, after the death of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, he launches an intellectual revolution to really stimulate the minds of the people. Because you have to also keep in mind that at this time of the fifth imam, again, this is 60, 70, 80 years after the hijrah, Islam had begun to spread to the east, to Persia, to what is Iran. It had gone to northern Europe. It had gone west into northwest Africa. It had covered a large portion of that part of the world. And so Muslims were now interacting with people of other religions, Hindus, Christians, Jewish people, atheists, agnostics. And so ideas were being brought from these different religions and philosophies into Islam. Books were being translated from other languages into Arabic. And Muslims themselves, because having been prohibited from knowing about religion for this 50, 60 year period, now they're faced with a dilemma that what do we understand of Islam? How do we understand this religion that Rasulullah brought? And so one of the things that we realize when we study the life of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is he brings forth an intellectual movement, a revolution of knowledge, so to speak, to show the people and to teach the masses of what true Islam is. And therefore you see thousands and thousands of hadith. In fact, we have traditionist narrators of hadith from the time of the fifth and sixth imam who would say that they had narrated 3,000, 4,000 statements from the imam. They would sit and listen to the imam and they would write everything the imam was saying down. So we see that that period was a definite revolution in knowledge. And so many of the hadith that we have from the fifth imam talk about tafsir of the Quran, for example, about ahkam, the jurisprudence. Because keep in mind that at this time also, the other four or the multiple madhahib that the Ahlul Sunnah follow, they're being starting to become formulated. Their scholars were coming into the world at this point in time. So the fifth imam was elaborating on ahkam. Aqidah, ideology, or theological belief, it became under attack. You had Mu'tazilites, you had the Khawarij, you had many other groups of Muslims who believed very strange things about Islam, about Allah, about the prophets. And so the fifth imam had to also counter theological deviancy. You know, what does the meaning of Allah? Does Allah have a physical body? Does he travel from place to place? You know, questions about the prophets. Are they infallible? Can they sin? Many of these issues. The fifth imam had to counter so many different issues on multiple levels that in addition to the hadith about specific sciences, like Quran, like aqaid, like fiqh, like Islamic ethics and morality, akhlaq, he also began to stress on the importance of seeking knowledge. Seeking knowledge became a key instrument in the life of the fifth imam to impart to the community that they needed to do everything that they could to go forth and gain an understanding of knowledge, gain an understanding of religion, to seek knowledge, just as Rasulullah had to do that 70 years prior, 80 years prior, when he began this movement of Islam, where he encouraged people to learn and he made an obligation on people to learn. It almost seems like that same Asr of Jahiliyyah, that same period of this decadence, was ruling over society at that time. So much so that the fifth imam, in many of his hadith, and I want to look at one tonight, had to show the importance to the community of going forth and seeking knowledge, but especially in matters of Islamic ideology. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So in this backdrop of the fifth imam making his way through Karbala and the tragedies of Karbala, seeing his forefathers and the family and companions being killed, seeing what Imam Zainul Abidin had to go through propagation in a silent form, through the du'as, the supplications. Once the fourth imam's shahada takes place, the fifth imam comes on the scene as the imam of the time. He begins this movement, and as I mentioned, because the Bani Umayyah were going through caliph after caliph and ruler after ruler, it basically kept them preoccupied with governance, and it gave the people, like the fifth imam and his companions and scholars at that time, it gave them an ideal opportunity to begin imparting knowledge. And so sometimes you'll read in books of history that when the fifth imam would lecture in Medina, that there would be hundreds, in fact some reports say thousands, of scholars, of researchers would be sitting and writing what the imam was teaching. Maybe there are no accurate numbers, but many of the historians mention numbers in the thousands of men who would sit at the feet of the imam and take in his teachings and impart, take this knowledge the imam was imparting and give it to the community. One of the traditions that I want to look at tonight from the fifth imam, he gives us three things to look for within our life. And he actually terms these as the perfection of a human being. You know, how we can become a complete human being. And there are many different traditions where such phrases are used, but the imam is focusing, and again, he was speaking for a particular era, a particular time, unique circumstances at his era, but we always understand that the words of the imam are eternal. They are as pertinent 1,300 years ago as they are today. And so in this tradition that I want to look at tonight, the imam talks about this kamal, this perfection, this completion that you and I can reach to. And he gives us three criteria that we can build upon to attain this completion of our spiritual traits. He says that the level one is tafaqquh fi din, a deep understanding of religion. Not ilm, not knowledge of religion, because there's a difference between ilm and tafaqquh, and I'll get into that very briefly tonight. He says that one of the things that we have to acquire is a deep understanding of religion. It can't be a superficial, you know, just a gloss over of our religion. It has to be much deeper than that. The second thing he points to is to have patience, sabr, this inner fortitude, this active dealing with a situation when we are going through challenges within our lives. And because I've talked about sabr in the past, I don't want to go over that topic again. But just to, you know, we'll gloss over it very briefly within the course of the hadith. And number three is where the Imam says that we have to have moderation. We need to be moderate in our standard of living. And given the economic crisis that Canada and the world is going through today, people losing their jobs, companies downsizing, people losing their income, families going from, you know, two income earners to a single income, we realize the importance at a practical level of moderation in our day-to-day life, in our spending habits, and how we go and, you know, use the money that we are earning. So inshallah, let's go through these three points from the fifth Imam and see how we can better understand and hopefully take something away and implement from the teachings of Ali Muhammad alayhim as-salatu was-salam. The very first thing that our fifth Imam talks about, he says, at-tafaqquh fi ad-deen, a deep understanding of the religion. Tafaqquh is also a term which Allah uses in the Quran. When you look at chapter number 9, Surah Tawbah, near to the end of the surah, it's perhaps the only verse of the Quran, it is actually the only verse of the Quran, in which Allah encourages you and I as a community to go forth and gain knowledge of Islam. And the verse is beautiful. Allah says that it doesn't befit the believers that they should all go forth to the battlefield. In this case, it means the battlefield. He says, why doesn't a group from every community go forth, لِيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الدِّينِ, that they may gain a deep understanding of religion? But Allah doesn't end there. He doesn't say, just go and get knowledge and keep it to yourself and don't spread it or share it. He says that when you gain that knowledge, then you come back to your qawm, to your community, and you teach them, you guide them, you warn them. Not that you go to another community which is not a part of your society. This is the only instance in the Quran where Allah shows us that we need to have individuals from every community go forth and gain a deep understanding of religion, and then come back and teach the community those things which they don't have time to do. Because let's face it, we know it for a fact, and Allah realizes that you and I don't all have the ability to go to the house and study. Not every single man, woman, and child from every community has the time, the ability, nor does the system allow for every single person to go and study Islam. We need doctors within our community. We need nurses. We need educators. We need teachers. We need engineers. We need computer programmers. We need graphic designers. We need people in every profession. If we expect the 12th Imam to return and lead a global movement, we have to have Muslims in every segment of society. Obviously, the permissible, the halal segments. And so Allah knows that we can build a society if there are only mullahs running around. If this community or society has 50,000 maulanas, 50,000 mujtahids, yeah, it's great for Islam. But guess what? You don't have doctors, you don't have lawyers, you don't have engineers, you don't have, you know, psychologists, you don't have people that you need to build a functional society, to build a functional community. Who will you need? Who will you call when you need an architect to build a new masjid? You need an architect who has credentials, who has experience. So Allah realizes that we can't all go and gain religion. So Allah says from every community, a group should go forth and not just go and study for a week or two. Or people today who feel, well, I can Google an article, I can watch a YouTube video, then go and give a majlis, I can go and deliver a khutbah because I read two books on the internet, I heard an alim say something, and so now I can go and regurgitate the same thing. No, we don't do that for any other science on earth. I won't go to a doctor who says, well, I read a book about how to do an open heart surgery. You know, they streamed it live on YouTube last year, a live open heart surgery, so let me test it on you. No, we would think that person is a bit upstairs, a bit not proper, and we ourselves would never give ourselves the opportunity to go to a doctor like that. But we go to spiritual doctors, we go to people who are not ulama, They're doctors, they're professionals, they're accountants, they may be good in their field, but guess what? They're not scholars. They're lawyers, they're a great lawyer, but they're not people who can deliver a fatwa. They're people who can maybe do an operation, but they can't operate on the spiritual heart. So the Imam says, go and get deep understanding of religion. You know, learn about Islam, not just what the books say, but become a person who can research, who can critically analyze situations, not just somebody who will say haram, halal, based on the marja. Yes, we need that. We need to know the marja's fatwa. But on all other areas, we don't necessarily go to the marja in those other areas. If we do, we go for advice. So tafakkuh fi deen is the first thing the Imam shares with us. Let me relate a beautiful story that happens at the time of the fifth Imam. Again, with his emphasis, Islam gives on knowledge. We have this beautiful hadith where the fifth Imam says that whenever his father, meaning the fourth Imam, Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam, whenever he would see students from his community, men or women, because again, women also need to be given the right to learn in our society, and women have the right to learn, even in the Hausa. If you go to Iran, for example, they have an entire school dedicated for women to study Islam in their own setting. So the fifth Imam says, whenever my father would see a group of students, men or women, he would get excited and he would call them towards him. And the fourth Imam would congratulate these people, these young men and women. And he would say that you are the safeguarders, you are the ones who are protecting knowledge of this community. And then he says something beautiful. He says that today you are the youth of the community, but tomorrow you're going to be the leaders of this society. And this is what it's all about, brothers and sisters. We who are with our gray hairs, maybe in 5, 10, 20 years, we're not going to be here anymore. We're going to be 6 feet under in the graveyard. But guess what? These young men and women in our community who are here, they're going to be the leaders of these communities. They're going to be the presidents of our jamaats. They're going to be the secretaries. They're going to be the leaders. They're going to be the religious leaders of our communities. And if we don't focus on them today, if we don't give them a chance to shine and show us what they're made of and guide them and put them on that path, become their mentors, become their big uncles, their big aunts, guess what? When we leave this world, we're not going to have people to run and maintain our centers. We're not going to have scholarship who are able to, you know, be concerned with the issues of the community at that particular time. And so we have to be aware and think critically as a community, as a Shia community globally, nationally, internationally, of where we're at in terms of leadership building and mentoring our youth, men and women, to become leaders of our societies. In many areas, not only these jamaats and institutions, but religious leadership. Today, when we look at the world around us, North America, just as a, you know, as a microcosm, we have many males who are scholars within our community who go and give lectures. But you look at the number of female scholars in Canada, and maybe I can point you and give you names of 3 or 4 that we know personally who have studied in the seminary, who have gotten to a level of education where they can give you answers based on traditional scholarship. 4 out of how many thousands of Shia women we have in Canada. And so women are forced to go to men for the answers, which is not a problem. But there are certain things that men can't understand. There are certain things that we don't experience that women go through. And if they don't have their own scholars to lean on, it makes it much more difficult for them to open up and speak about personal issues. So we have to be conscious and aware of this. And maybe many of us are not in a level to change this aspect. But we have to push our leadership at local, at national, international levels to make sure that this is thought about and we make an active plan to encourage youth, men and women, pay them, give them scholarships to go and study Islam. And not a conditional scholarship that you come and we'll pay you and you have to come back and serve us. No, give it as an open grant to students to go and study. And I'm sure when they come back, they'll feel a sense of indebtedness to want to help the community and want them to grow and go towards the zuhur of our 12th Imam. And if we have such young men and women in our community, then our jamaats, our organizations, it is wajib As Ayatollah Mishkini, the late Ayatollah Mishkini, wrote in his book, he says it becomes wajib on a community when you have a man or a woman who goes to study in the Hawza. He says they have now lifted the obligation off all of us, but now it becomes our wajibat to financially support them along the way. And if we don't do it, we have committed a sin against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So let me just sum up point number one from the fifth imam is tafaqquh fi deen, that we have to be individuals who go deep in our religion, not just a superficial understanding that we Google. No, we need to go deep and understand Quran and ahkam, ideology, the tawheed of Allah, nubuwat, all of these things. We have to have a deep understanding of them. The imam then talks about at point number two is patience in the face of tribulation and adversity. And again, I've talked about this in the past at length of the true definition of sabr, that it means an active role that we play, because patience can mean two things. Sometimes you're patient and you can't do anything to change your situation. You go, for example, to your doctor, and the receptionist says, take a number, the doctor will be with you when your turn comes up. So you sit and you wait and you do nothing because you can't speed up the doctor seeing you. You just wait there until your number is called. But sometimes you're trying to attain a goal and you have to go through challenges. People who are, you know, sports players have to go and work out and, you know, exercise and build themselves up. So their sabr is to work hard to get to their goal, to compete, let's say, in the Olympics or in a major sporting event. We have to be at the second level of patience, that our goal is whatever it is, and we're going to overcome all of our challenges to reach to that destination. That's what sabr is in Islam. It doesn't mean to sit back and take whatever is happening and deal with and just, you know, put up with the challenges. No, it means to actively do what you can do to make the situation better. And last but not least, and I'll wrap up with this tonight, is moderation in one's excesses, moderation in one's standard of living. We know when we look around us again that the economy is not what we would like it to be. And even if it were at where we wanted it to be, who is to say that something might not happen overnight to change the entire situation? We just have the example in front of us. You know, I don't have to go to the stock market crash in the 30s or all of these problems. Just 3 months ago in Edmonton, we saw the forest fires that ravaged Fort McMurray. Literally, within a few hours, 80,000 people had to flee their homes. Their jobs were put on hold. Their careers were on hold. They didn't know, were their homes destroyed? Was their business completely obliterated? Where would they sleep? Where would they eat? What would they eat? They had no idea. We don't know, could that happen to us? We could be, you know, at the top of our career today. We could be coming home and have an accident on the road, be a quadriplegic, be in a coma for life. And what will our family do? What will our children do? How will they take care of themselves? How will they survive? Nobody knows. As Allah says in the Quran, nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. Nobody knows on what earth, what land we're going to die in. People came to visit cities, and they came to visit their family, and they ended up dying 40, you know, thousands of kilometers from home. They didn't expect to die there, but they left their world. They left the world on a vacation. So we don't know what's going to happen to us. We don't know what's going to happen in terms of our income. So the fifth imam shows us when it comes to our spending habits, we need to keep them under control. You know, sometimes people are riding on that wave of economic prosperity. They have a nice house. They've got two cars in the driveway. And they say, you know what, I'm going to go buy a second house because I'm making so much money. I can afford a second mortgage. I can afford that interest payment that I'm paying. And it's an investment property. I'm going to pay it off. I'm going to sell it and make more money. And then I can buy another property, or I can do this. I can do that. And then guess what? They lose their job, as I'm sure many of us have seen. Some unforeseen tragedy happens to them. And guess what? Now they're stuck paying for two homes. They don't have mortgage payments for either home, and they don't have a job. And you know that EI doesn't give but 60% of your income. So you see that in an instant, our life can change. But if we're moderate in our spending, and moderate doesn't mean that you're miserly, that you don't feed your family, that you don't have a decent life, but it means that you don't go beyond excesses, that you have a controlled expenditure. And for everybody, that would be different. You know, your own accountant, your own soul can tell you what you should be spending, what you shouldn't be spending. And so each and every one of us have to consider this for ourselves. But it's something that the fifth Imam shows us, that our spending has to be under control. And I'll end with this before I just mention a few words about the shahadat of our fifth Imam, that everything Islam shows us, or every teaching that we have in Islam, is about moderation. Fasting, don't fast every day. Don't become an excessive, compulsive faster. Praying, we're not told to pray 1,000 rakat a day. No, keep it under control. Don't go to excess in religion. Don't become an extremist in religion. Giving in charity, people give sadaqah, give all this khairat, all this goodness. Allah says, don't give everything in charity, and nor be so cheap and give nothing, but choose something in the middle. Give a little bit in charity, and keep some for a rainy day. Keep some for your family. Keep some for your children's education. Keep some for ziyarat, for hajj. Save up for these actions. Don't be so, you know, generous to give everything away in charity. So Islam shows us, be moderate in everything you do. Even ibadat has moderation within it. And as we close, we realize that it's these teachings of moderation, of neither being at either extreme, of being a moderate, not what the West calls a moderate Muslim, but being moderate meaning we're balanced in our understanding of Islam, and we're balanced in our implementation of Islam. It's beautiful teachings such as this that brought the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam the ultimate gift of shahadat. And really that's what it is, because every one of our imams who was killed, it was nothing but a gift from Allah. For us, it is times like this where we don black clothes and we cry and we lament over the martyrdom of our imams. But for them, this is the greatest blessing that they could have received. And we see what Imam Ali was killed when he was attacked in Masjid al-Kufa. He didn't cry, or he didn't, you know, feel sorrow for himself. He says what? He says, Fustu wa Rabbil Kaaba. By the Lord of the Kaaba, I have been successful. And this was the tradition of every one of our imams, including our fifth Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, who, as he was beginning to develop a larger following of people in Medina, as they began to attend his lessons and learn more and more of his version of Islam, the government of the time, the Bani Umayyah, realized that this would be a challenge to their authority, although he wasn't addressing them politically. But the Umayyad government realized that through a religious revolution, through an intellectual revolution brought about by Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam, that could easily be transformed into a political movement, that people would pledge their allegiance to the Imam, and eventually they would give the Imam the status of the leadership of the society. And we see that for the fifth Imam, during the time of Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, it was either him or one of his relatives who were told in the books of history that they realized that the fifth Imam was getting a bit too powerful in Medina. He had embarrassed the Khalifa in Sham. He had shown him up when he went to Hajj in Mecca. And now in Medina, he was also being a force to be reckoned with. And so although the details are scarce about the shahadat of our fifth Imam, but Sheikh Abbas Akumi, in his book Muntaha Al-A'mal, he quotes from various sources where the government of the time or one of their advisors ended up poisoning the fifth Imam. And as before the fifth Imam is about to die, he calls his son, the sixth Imam, Imam Jafar as-Sadiq. He tells him to come near, and he tells the sixth Imam to call some of my Shia to the home. The fifth Imam begins to give his wasiya, his last will. He tells his son, the sixth Imam, he says, "O Jafar," he says, "in the presence of all of these witnesses, I let you bear witness that you are the one who should, after my death, give me my ghusl. You bury me in my coffin, in my three shrouds." And then he says that you give me the burial and bury me in Jannatul Baqi. And we know that the fifth Imam was later on buried right beside his father and his uncle. And the only reason why we're told, when the fifth Imam was asked why he did this, he says, "My only reason for bringing all these witnesses is for them to realize that once I die, that you are the Imam after me." And as we know that once the fifth Imam leaves this world, the sixth Imam is there right beside his father to comfort him, to give him that last farewell, to give him the ghusl, to wash his body and to give him the proper burial that he so deserved. But we recall that tragedy of Ashura, where Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Bakr alayhi salam witnesses the greatest in sacrifice of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, and he sees his grandfather being strewn on the plains of Karbala, when he sees his grandfather being chopped into pieces on the day of Ashura, and that there's nobody there to help him. There's nobody there to answer that call of Hal min Nasir and Yansurna, because each and every one of the family members and companions have already left this world and have gone back to Allah. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. Ya Allah, we ask you on this night where we mark the martyrdom anniversary of our fifth Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, that you accept this act of worship from us tonight. We ask you to forgive us all of our sins, and we ask you to keep us all, ourselves, our children, our spouses, on the path of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Let us not leave this world until we see the dhuhur of our 12th Imam. And Ya Allah, if we are destined to leave this world before his advent, bring us up on the day, on the time of the Rajat, to be helpers and assistants of our 12th Imam. Let us close by once again remembering our marhumin. Many of us have family members who are no longer with us tonight, who were here maybe last year with us. For their thawab, for the thawab of all the marhumin from our family, our friends, the ulama, the shuhada, Surah Mubarakatul Fatiha, but before that, one loud salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.